Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. I hope that's a habit with you guys now.
I don't know whether it's a bad habit or a good habit.
It's a good habit.
It's a good habit. Okay, yeah. Well, what are we doing this week? We're freshly back from one of the most popular restaurant cities in the country, New Orleans, Louisiana, known as the Crescent City, also known as NOLA. And we were there for the New Orleans wine and food experience, and that was fun. But more interestingly, we tracked down three very capable new young chefs. I mean, new to being in charge of kitchens, who we want to introduce to you today. Two of them, it turns out, are with the John Besh Restaurant Group. And so you'll hear about Domenica and La Provence. And then a restaurant new to us, and new to many people because it's new to New Orleans, called Maison 923. And then we're going to close out today's program on the subject of, why would you be so crazy as to want to go train to be a chef at age 38? A rather fascinating discussion when you line it up compared to the three very young men who were starting out our program today. So first up, what did we say? We said to each other, this is one of the best meals we had for a very, very long time.
Yes, I absolutely love Domenica, which, of course, means Sunday in Italian, which is what it's about, the whole restaurant's about. Family get-togethers, wonderful, wonderful, and lots of food, and boy, did we have a good meal.
So let's go find out.
I'm really enjoying the artwork at Domenica. We're going to be talking to the executive chef, partner, Alon Shaya. I got that right, Alon,
yes,
right?
Yes, ma'am.
But the artwork at Domenica is totally arresting. Who picked that?
The artwork was picked by myself, Octavio, John Besh, and Shay Baralt, who was our designer. We all kind of had our ideas of what we wanted in the restaurant, and we all went to the galleries to check it out, and you'll find in Italy that a lot of the artwork is very surprising, that in restaurants in Italy there's always a lot of very modern art and very rustic food, and so I wanted this restaurant to kind of have that same vibe. I wanted it to be surprising to people and not so predictable.
And you came up with that idea because you were in Italy.
Oh, yeah.
So you saw it for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, the way that they combine, the way that the Italians combine history and the future and progression, I think is very amazing. And the way that they seamlessly are able to combine tradition with progression, I think it's great. And so I wanted it, we have a wood-burning pizza oven, but it's in the kitchen, where nobody can see it. And we have a salumi bar in plain view.
And you have hanging salumi. I saw it. It's fabulous.
Yeah, and we hang and cure all of our own meats. And so that's another thing that's very unpredictable. That's not expected of an Italian restaurant in America. And so that's why we came up with these ideas to kind of keep it going.
Now, you remember Osteria Francescana's Big Red Ferrari.
Yeah. He is a contemporary art collection.
Sure. Yeah.
But his wife is Kodak era.
She's a member of the Eastman family.
Eastman family, right. But anyhow, we've jumped ahead too far here. Let's go back to the fact that Alon is Israeli-born, Philadelphia-raised, and where trained?
Went to culinary school, the Culinary Institute of America in New York.
Okay.
And then continued with working after that in Las Vegas, St. Louis, and then I came to New Orleans.
Okay. You were discovered, actually, by a partner in this, what do you call the...
Octavio. The partner, co-owner of Besh Restaurant Group, Octavio Montilla.
He's fabulous.
He's amazing.
We just met him yesterday. But he discovered you and brought you on board at August. No, at Steakhouse?
At Besh Steak.
Besh Steak.
Yes. So Octavio and I have known each other for about 12 years now.
That's a long time.
Oh, yeah. And we worked together in St. Louis. And we became great friends. And when he came back to New Orleans, he asked me to come down and visit. And I said, of course, I've always wanted to come to New Orleans. It's been always on my hit list of places because it's such a food town. So I came to visit Octavio in New Orleans, and he introduced me to John Besh. And I just fell in love with John. I fell in love with Restaurant August because I had dinner there. I fell in love with the city and the culture of it. And I just, there's no other place that I wanted to be. And so within 2 weeks, I had packed everything up, came to New Orleans, and became the chef of Besh Steakhouse.
Now, listeners, you have to understand that there's real meaning to what Chef just said about Restaurant August, because John Besh wasn't really playing entirely fair.
Oh, well.
In persuading someone to come and join his culinary empire, he did turn you on to probably the best dinner you could ever get in New Orleans.
It was amazing. And the second that I had dinner there and I met John, I knew that that was somebody that I could really learn from, and I knew that it was a team that I wanted to be a part of. And this is still when it was only Restaurant August. This is before the steakhouse had even opened.
Well, now let's fast forward. You were a chef partner in this restaurant, which is Italian. Now, you had the perfect fit for that anyhow, or did that happen afterwards?
No, I had always cooked Italian food. And Italian, when I started working in restaurants at the age of 14, I was cooking Italian food.
Were you in South? No, you were not.
In Manayunk.
Manayunk. Oh, there you go.
Uh-huh. I was cooking for a guy named Derek Davis at Sonoma. And it was this California Italian cuisine. And so I had always, growing up Israeli, the flavors of Italian cooking always just made a lot of sense to me. Because it's roasted peppers and eggplant and olives.
And that's Israeli
and
cuisine.
Olive oil. And it's Israeli cuisine as well. And so it's just this Mediterranean influence that I had growing up. I really saw a lot of that in Italian cuisine, and so
well,
I was just drawn to that.
You came here when you were four.
Yeah.
How often do you go back to Israel?
We would go back every year to visit my grandparents.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but we would also cook Israeli food at the house.
Uh-huh.
You know, we continued the traditions of what my family cooked while they lived in Israel. They cooked here in Philadelphia. So I have always cooked Italian food, and it's always been my true passion for food.
Well, you know what I'm surprised about is we have not yet had our dinner at Domenica. I have not eaten here yet. But I was awakened by John Besh's last cookbook to the fact, and some other sources, that actually the great exodus from Sicily ended up in New Orleans.
Absolutely.
And so the real colonization of Italian food in New Orleans is Sicilian, but this is, I understood, was a northern Italian restaurant.
It is. Well,
but you have margarita pizza, that's Napoleon.
Yeah.
I mean, Napoleon.
Yeah, well, I lived in Italy. I lived in Parma, and I lived in Bergamo.
That's north, yeah.
And so a lot of the influence that I have in my cooking comes from the places that I spent the most time in Italy. So I do love cooking southern Italian food, and I dabble in it, but I know more about northern Italian cuisine because that's just where I spent more time. And the restaurants that I had worked in previous to opening Domenica had all been northern Italians type restaurants
okay,
as well.
Okay, so that's the tone of Domenica.
Absolutely.
You have so many wonderful touches here, like you were talking about the charcuterie. You can look through the window, like into an open kitchen, and see the stuff hanging.
Yeah. Well, that was when I lived in Parma, which is the capital
of
cured meats.
Exactly.
I worked with a family curing meats, making prosciutto and pancetta and culatello. And that's the one thing that I thought, if you can explain this cuisine in an art form, cured meats, the salumi is it, because it takes such an art to make it. It is not a science. It is not just regular cooking.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is an art form. And so I wanted to set the tone of Domenica with that. And that's why we have this custom-built salumi aging case right in the dining room.
Whew. What else is really unique about Domenica?
Well, kind of like my life story, this restaurant and the menu.
You love this restaurant. You really have ownership of the concept.
Well, you know, I feel like it is me. Like, I feel like the time that I've been cooking Italian food and my passion for Italy and the food all kind of came together here at Domenica. And when I look through the menu, I can just look at a menu item and think to the little old lady in Italy that taught me how to make it. Or I can think to the chef that I worked for in Italy that spent hours with me perfecting this recipe. And so it really is personal to me. And we do a lot of really fun stuff. We bake our ciabatta bread every morning in a wood-burning oven that we use to make our pizzas. We make all of our own liqueurs, limoncello.
Oh, you do, really?
And we have about 18 different flavors of different liqueurs that we make. Cento Erba, Fragolino, a strawberry liqueur, a Nocino. We do all kinds of different ones. We, of course, make all of our own pastas. We make all of our doughs for pizza and focaccia and torta frita, which is one of my favorite things in the whole world, which are these, like, fried dough that you eat with the salumi. So,
you know, I grew up in that, but, I mean, my background's Sicilian. I didn't know it was also Northern Italian.
Yeah.
Fried dough, that's a big thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, if you ask me to what's my favorite thing on the menu or what is most special, it's a very hard question for me to answer because it's all so amazing to me.
Now, is there a reason that it's called Sunday?
Yeah, Domenica means Sunday in Italian, and Sundays in Italy were the days that I had off that I would be able to go and explore restaurants, explore wineries, travel with the family that I was working for, and we would all go out to eat together at these restaurants, mostly in Emilia-Romagna, where we would eat prosciutto and torta frita and drink Lambrusco and just have these big long tables and food would be passed around and wine would be passed around. And it was the day in Italy that I felt like I was Italian. Like I felt like I was part of the family. And so I wanted our guests here at Domenica to have that same feeling. And so the way that we kind of put this whole restaurant together was with that in mind. When people came to Domenica, that they felt like they could relax, pass food around, pass wine around, enjoy, and just be family. And so that's why we wanted to name the restaurant Domenica.
It's really interesting because in our experiences in Italy, one of the most challenging reservations to get
is Sunday
lunch. I can remember driving through sections of Italy and without realizing it, that it was First Communion Sunday. Restaurant after restaurant.
They were booked.
Went by.
They were booked solid.
They were totally full. They couldn't find room for two more people. So we understand that it's a really special meal. And it's lunchtime, too.
It is. And I'm sure you remember.
And then you sleep.
Hundreds of kids running around the tables while the adults ate and drank. And then they'd sit around for hours drinking grappa and it would just,
we could tell you stories.
Lunch ends just around 5:30 p.m., right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
But no, I don't want to give a false impression that we are in some kind of a rustic Italian restaurant.
This is
a very, very smart restaurant. As I already commented, the artwork is arresting and very stylish, comfortable but stylish. Modern. Have you modernized the dishes you're doing, too?
No, I have not. The dishes are very rustic, very traditional food. And I found one of the things the Italians do best is they really know how to preserve the past while they think, while they have forward thinking. And if you look at Italian cars and Italian clothes and Italian furniture design, it's some of the most interesting and modern in the entire world.
Yeah.
But then you think about Italian food and the churches and the city centers and the religion, and it's some of the most historic and some of the most well-preserved traditions. And that's what I always admired, that they can preserve these traditions, like a lasagna bolognese, which the recipe hasn't changed for hundreds of years. But at the same time, they can have these amazing restaurants that serve these rustic dishes with incredible artwork, incredible architecture, very modern-style kitchens, very modern-style dining rooms. And I always admired that.
So, yeah, well, we have a friend who's – and this is – she's just representative of a number of friends. She's very urbane, very sophisticated, very with it. an independent woman, and she sent me an email encouraging me to try to put some kind of vote someplace about the canonization of Pope John Paul. And I never expected any kind of religious anything from this woman. I was really astounded. And that, to me, is like part of this kind of funny contrast between tradition and modern.
Sure. Yeah, that's what makes them so special.
Let's talk about dishes. We're going to have dinner here,
yes, ma'am.
I know I'm going to be absolutely overwhelmed with good flavor. I could just tell. I mean, I love this food.
Well, I hope so.
What actually are you proudest of that you'd like to mention as dishes?
Well, we have an amazing pizza oven back there, and I worked for a pizzaiolo in Parma who was from Basilicata.
Just outside
of Napoli. And he was a genius for pizza. His name was Enzo. And so,
of course,
yeah, why not, right? So the pizzas I'm very proud of. I really love working with the dough, making the pizzas. I even have a pizza named after him, the Pizza Enzo, which is my favorite one.
Okay, what's in that?
It's anchovies, mortadella, basil, tomatoes, spicy chilies, and oregano.
Couldn't be wrong. What could be wrong with that one?
And that was the pizza that he would make for us at the end of the shift every night. And we would drink grappa and eat Pizza Enzo's. And
I hope it was good grappa, not the stuff.
Oh, it was the best. It was the best. And he wouldn't cook this pizza for any of his customers. It was only for the people that he worked with. And I thought it was the best pizza he made. And so I said, Enzo, when I get back to New Orleans, I'm going to put this pizza on my menu and name it after you. And he, I think, got a kick out of that. And he came, actually, and spent a week making pizzas with us here last year.
Oh, that's great.
And every time the Pizza Enzo was ordered in the kitchen, you could see a little grin on his face. And
aww.
So I really love that dish. I love the octopus carpaccio.
You read my mind. I was going to say, I have to have that.
That's an amazing dish.
That's my favorite
and
thing in the world.
That's the dish that I would eat on the beaches in Tuscany. In the middle of the day, after you spend the morning on the beach, you go and you eat either fritto misto or octopus carpaccio in the restaurants along the beaches. I love the stracci pasta, which is a spinach pasta that's torn and tossed with an oxtail ragu and topped with fried chicken livers.
I think you're, what do you call that when you're reading somebody's mind? You're channeling me, because that's the stuff I was going to say next.
Well, good cooks think alike, right? Have similar minds. I love the squid ink tagliolini, which is a pasta that we make with squid ink. It's very black, and we toss it with a jumbo lump crab meat from here.
Oh, wow.
In Lake Pontchartrain, and fresh herbs. I love the lasagna bolognese. It's a dish that was taught to me by an 83-year-old woman named Nonna in Bologna, and she taught me that dish, and I've had it on the menu since we've opened. I love the gianduja budino for dessert, which is a dish that I worked with a chef named Eddie, and she was one of the most influential chefs in my life. And
what's her name?
Eddie. Edgarda.
Edgarda.
But we call her Eddie. And the gianduja budino is her recipe. So there's a lot of dishes
Listeners, in case you're wondering, this is chocolate and hazelnut pudding with candied hazelnuts. Could anything be wrong with that?
Well,
this is
tasty.
An astounding menu.
Thank you.
And how often does it change?
It changes every couple months, along with the seasons. Every couple weeks, I'll maybe take one thing off and put one thing on. But every 2 months or so, we'll switch out about 8 or 9 dishes and keep it really, really fresh with whatever's local. Starting tomorrow, there'll be peaches and blueberries and heirloom tomatoes all over the menu.
Oh, heirloom tomatoes.
And
right.
That's because that's what's, at, you know, just this week started at the farmer's market.
Well, this is an exciting menu and an exciting restaurant. Everything from the decor, the ambience, just the thoughtfulness that you put into it, it's just so personalized. I could hardly wait.
Thank you.
Now, let's double check. Because Sunday lunchtime, some restaurants are closed. Do tell us days of the week and meal times that you're open.
We're open 7 days a week from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m.
So you can't miss it.
You can't miss it.
7 days a week. Wow.
We make it very easy for anybody who's hungry to come in our doors.
And the location is the Hotel Roosevelt, which used to be the Fairmont.
Correct.
On Barone Street, just off Canal Street. the best way to get to the website is probably just to go to chefjohnbesh.com.
That or DominicaRestaurant.com.
Or DominicaRestaurant.com. So we're gonna stop all this working stuff here, and we're going to have something to eat and drink.
Alan, this has been such a pleasure. I'm so glad that we got to meet you and talk.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Stay with us while we take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. Domenica, as we said, is of the John Besh Group, and another one from the John Besh Group is La Provence, where we have eaten in the past, but there is a bright, energetic new chef there now, and talking to him was so wonderful that we can hardly wait to go and actually go and eat there. So let's listen to La Provence. Well, the last time we were at La Provence was more than several years ago, I guess, and we had such a good time. I wish we could go back there again this time, but I'm putting this on my calendar. Next time we're in the area, we're going to go back and see what the new chef is doing, Eric Loos IV, who has been there for how long?
About 2.5 years.
2.5 years. But you've been through John Besh's restaurants before, including where we are now at August.
Absolutely. I spent my first 5.5 years in the company at Restaurant August, which was really my culinary boot camp into the company and got me in shape to be the chef de cuisine over at La Provence.
Well, now, you were from Southern California.
Yep.
A graduate of the California Culinary Institute. Is it institute or college?
Academy.
Academy. I knew it was not institute. What attracted you to food?
Well, it started off cooking as a boy with my mom in the kitchen, and just being in the kitchen and cooking and serving people was something that I liked to do, and creating was a big thing. It was like another art form of using food as a pencil and paper, basically. And so
you're art inclined, are you?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
So far.
I mean, was it a toss-up between this career and some other career, or just directly it was food?
I started cooking in professional kitchens when I was about 16, and at that time I was in high school going through a creative design program, and so I was looking into doing graphic design on computers. And I just, once I started working in restaurants, then that really took over right away.
Great. Now, I guess we need to have a little explanation of, first of all, how did you get from San Francisco to New Orleans?
I started at the California Culinary Academy in 2002, and it's a year-long program. One of the chefs that I actually wasn't taught by him, but I delivered foods in the mornings to the classrooms. I worked in the receiving department at the school, and so in the mornings I would just chat with him as I dropped off the food and told him where I was in the program, and he started describing the restaurants he worked at in New Orleans. And what else does every other 16-year-old boy want to do but go party in Mardi Gras and see New Orleans? And being so far away, I did especially. And as we continued to talk, he described some of the restaurants that he worked at and the chefs that he worked with. And just the food culture down here is totally different. And every major gathering and holiday and sports event and everything is based around food. And it's such a family and food environment that I was drawn towards it.
It really is. Now, La Provence is not in New Orleans proper.
Nope.
Could you locate it for us?
It's in Lacombe, Louisiana, which is about 45 minutes across the Pontchartrain Causeway.
And how do people, if they're just in New Orleans, get there?
You need to rent a car. Cause
yeah, that's what we did.
The practical thing is not taking a taxi, really. You need a car yourself.
Right. Didn't we rent a car? Yeah.
Yep.
Now, La Provence itself has an interesting history. John Besh, his mentor, started it and ran it for years, right?
Right. Chef Chris started the restaurant in 73 is when they opened. And when John Besh was the chef de cuisine there, he was exactly my age now and doing the same job that I'm doing now under Chef Chris. And so it's neat to see how things that Chef Chris taught Chef Besh, he's now teaching me and moving forward, passing it down a generation.
And how old is that, by the way? How old are you?
27.
27, you're still eligible for this Risings. I never find anybody under 30 that's in this position.
Now you found somebody.
I found somebody. You said there have been a number of changes. I mean, the first thing I would note is that I don't think they raised pigs when we were there.
Chef Besh put the farm in initially when he first bought the restaurant.
Oh, he did.
And the chicken coop and the raised beds. And so they planted fig trees and had Berkshire pigs and egg-laying chickens.
Uh-huh. But now you have to remember he emailed about getting the those woolly pigs.
Yep.
The Mangalista.
Yep. We got the Mangalitas about a year and a half ago. We actually just slaughtered our first batch of pigs and split it up between the restaurants. We kind of share the weight of them on the restaurants. They help work on the farm. Cooks come out from other restaurants.
I noticed that you had Mangalista pork on the menu yesterday.
Yep.
But that's the very first crop.
Yes, this is the first crop. And we've taken a few of the pigs for special events in the past year or so when they were a little bit smaller. These ones were very large pigs. They were about 400 pounds.
Yeah, they're a lot more fat, don't they?
Yeah, they're meant to be cured and dried and preserved. It's a Hungarian breed of pig that was crossbred in 1833.
They're cute, the curly hair.
They're very fuzzy.
And are they very nice, pleasant disposition?
They'll walk right up to you and start sniffing your shoes and see if you have anything good they can taste on them.
Cute.
They're like little puppies.
But what other changes have you made in the style of the restaurant?
We really try to respect the style that Chef Chris had at the restaurant, and Joyce is still there. We just passed her 31st anniversary at the restaurant
Wow.
a couple of months
this
ago.
This is the lady who makes killer Sazeracs?
Yep.
They are killer Sazeracs. Oh, yeah.
They were absolutely, I don't know what was in them. I didn't ask. I just said, can you make a Sazerac? And she said, I've been doing it for, I think it was then probably 26 years, and now she's doing it on 31.
Yep.
And you better not step out of line with Miss Joyce, right?
She is the queen of the restaurant. It took me several tries to work on Chef Chris's recipes to serve it before she approved them.
She had approved them.
The quail gumbo in particular is something that's been on the menu I can't even tell you how long, and it took me about four tries before she said it was like Chris's, or just about as good as Chris's. Definitely not as good.
Oh, that's fun. You must be quite a diplomat to be able to fill out all this, huh?
Yeah, and then there's Dale, too. So Dale Harvey is the general manager, and we all work together over there.
Now, what are some of the other dishes that are, somebody's going there, what can they expect, signature dishes?
One of my favorites is the Creole cream cheese malfati.
What is that?
A Creole cream cheese malfati. It's a little...
I know malfati, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we make them with Creole cream cheese. It's really similar to a gnocchi, and we serve it with our house-cured bacon, cherry tomatoes, and English peas. And the broth is full of herbs and a little bit of butter and shallots and garlic. It's awesome.
Sounds great.
Yep. Yeah.
Any other?
We do something in respect of Chef Chris that's just a little bit different. He always had a slow-cooked rabbit on the menu.
Rabbit.
And
I
so
love, me too. I love it.
So what we do is braise the rabbit and pick the meat off the bone and stuff it into raviolis and serve it with a really slow-cooked onion and tomato sauce. And right now we have some really great pea tendrils and artichokes and shaved Parmesan cheese.
You know, how many different things do you grow in that garden?
About 20 or 30. We really do better with herbs and lettuces, but we also have blueberry bushes, figs. We do a strawberry patch every year, parsley, chives, dill, sage, tarragon, and my favorite is lemon verbena that we make sorbets
Everybody
with.
Everybody loves that, yeah.
It has such a different flavor than anything I've ever tasted.
Yeah, I've tried to grow it, and since I don't make a sorbet, it doesn't really matter because I don't know what to do with it.
You can make tea with it as well. It makes a really great
tea. Do you have a website that you do? Is your menu on the website?
Yeah, we usually keep it pretty updated.
It's called LaProvenceRestaurant.com, right?
Yep. And if you go to any of the Besh restaurants, they'll lead you back to a main page, and you can look at them all together or lead you from one to the other.
Well, you must be excited being there, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm honored to be in charge of such a culture and food-rich restaurant that's been there for so long.
The whole thing with this operation that I have to comment on over and over again is everybody's so nice.
Yeah.
Have you noticed?
They are. We really try to serve people, and that's what we do, is to make you feel at home and make you happy, really, when you come into the restaurants.
Right. And if somebody goes there, I mean, how long a drive is it?
Um, I It's about 45 minutes from here at Restaurant August. Yeah. I used to live right down the street, just a few blocks away, and it's easily under an hour, unless you're trying to do it during rush hour.
And you stay there now? I mean, you live.
Yep, my wife and I just moved to Madisonville, which is about a half hour in the other direction.
Uh huh.
Yep.
But you have to come here frequently.
Actually, not very often.
No.
I'm really closed off to the restaurant, and if I need to borrow something, or often cooks come across the lake, it's really not very often.
Well, then I'm really very delighted that we caught you. Yeah, Thank you for doing that.
How are we so fortunate to catch up with you today?
Well, I'm actually going to go on another radio show pretty soon here.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Kendra said you have another appointment at 3.
Yep.
What are you going to talk about?
The Cochon 555 competition this weekend.
Oh, that's right. You're in that.
Yep.
Oh, please tell us some more. Please tell us some more about that, because we're going to miss the main part of that event because it's on Saturday after we've gone home.
Okay.
So please explain that.
The competition is really to raise awareness about heritage breed pigs. And, of course, we're going to use one of our pigs from the backyard, a Mangalitsa. And the competition called 555 is 5 pigs, 5 winemakers, and 5 chefs. And
so in different cities.
In different cities. We do it in 10 cities across the country every year. And the winners from that go to the Grand Cochon, which will be at the Aspen Food and Wine Classic. Okay. And the Grand Cochon winners go on to the next level of All-Stars they just announced.
And what level is that?
That'll be the third.
There'll be another competition.
Now, you're up against some pretty tough competition, I think.
Yeah, a couple local guys. The first one is Steven Strajewski from
Cochon.
From Cochon, yeah.
And then
he might sound like he has the inside track.
Yeah, he's got the name right. And then there's Adolfo Garcia.
From Rio Mar.
Rio Mar, yeah. Yep. I love Rio Mar, yeah.
And then there's also Mike Lotta from Fig in
Charleston.
I love
Mike, too. He's another good buddy.
And then John Currents.
Where is he now?
He's Oxford, Mississippi.
He's where?
He's in Oxford, Mississippi.
Yeah.
He has a restaurant with a funny name.
What is the name of his restaurant?
It's called City something. It's an
City
odd
Grocery.
City Grocery.
City Grocery.
Doesn't sound like a restaurant at all.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
He's been on the program, I'm pretty sure.
He has several restaurants and venues out there.
Right.
We're going to get a preview. I don't remember where during this conference. We're getting a preview.
There's a preview, I think, on Friday evening, isn't there? I think something's going on.
Some kind of
preview during the grand tasting on Friday.
Well, Brady's down here, and he's actually going to be at the radio show here in a minute. Brady Lowe, the founder of Taste Network and the Cochon 555, and so we're going to go talk on the radio pretty soon here.
It launched already from New York, didn't it?
New York was about 6 or 8 months ago. They do one to two a month.
A while, yeah.
Yeah, and this is the third year.
Exciting! Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Well, good luck
excited.
To you.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Now what's your secret? Do you have a secret?
So far, slow cooking is the way to go with the pig.
You can give us away the secret. This won't broadcast until after the competition in New Orleans is over.
Yep.
So if you have another secret, you could reveal it.
I'm just going to slow cook a few different parts of the pig and put them back together the right way, and we're going to do 4 dishes, and we'll present them on Saturday.
Wow.
I'm sure they'll have pictures up on the website. They have a really good photo gallery up there.
I hope you have a good time. I wish you, as I said, good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you again for talking to us.
And listen, hold on a minute. This is an absolutely lovely young man. I bet your mother is so proud of him.
She is, absolutely.
And he looks a little bit like American Idol Scotty.
I haven't seen him.
You don't sing on the side?
No, definitely not. Cooking's about as far as I go, and a little bit of farming.
Well, we're so glad to have had the opportunity to meet you in person, and we'll rectify the situation in terms of having the opportunity to eat at your premises.
Please do.
On another trip to Louisiana.
So.
And now it's time for another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
You're listening to On the Menu, of course, and next up is going to be what it was for us, a brand new experience. We never knew Maison 923 existed, and we're certainly delighted that we found it. Listen in. Well, we are, to us, a new restaurant. In fact, it is new, being like a year old. It's called Maison 923, and we're talking to the chef de cuisine, Barak Rabassa, and I'm so delighted to meet you and to be here because it's a new experience, and we've been coming to New Orleans forever and ever and ever. I said New Orleans. Give us a hint where exactly. We're in the Warehouse District.
We're in the Warehouse District, coming uptown, right across from the Howlin' Wolf. It's the upcoming neighborhood in New Orleans.
What's it called?
The Warehouse District.
No, the other one.
Oh, we're across the street from the Howlin' Wolf, which is a famous music venue.
Oh, okay.
And in between the French Quarter and uptown New Orleans. So it's the up-and-coming Warehouse District of New Orleans.
Well, it's a very smart decor. It's very comfortable being. Who comes here? What kind of clientele do you do?
We have a mix of locals and out-of-town tourists that are very much in the food kind of know-how. And then we have people that just kind of walk in out of the beaten path that didn't expect to walk into what they did.
Yeah, well, I could see that, too. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about your background because it is, to say the least, colorful. I mean, you've been everywhere. You've just gone everywhere, and you've done most everything, and you come from a very interesting background. It's so complicated. Is there some way you can condense it so that our listeners get an idea of where you're coming from?
Yeah, I have. I grew up in an eclectic household that was multicultural, and father's academic, does work in pretty much all Latin American-based countries, so we had the opportunity to travel our whole childhood. And
that's the name then? Maison, yes. Is that the same as Maison?
No, it's a different. Maison, the French Maison refers to
house.
A house. The Spanish Maison refers to a establishment of hospitality, whether it's an inn, a hotel, or a restaurant.
Oh, that's interesting.
So they kind of both have some similarities, but at the same time are very different.
I see. And then is this 923 the address, right?
923 is the address on...
Okay, you were born where? You've lived everywhere, haven't you?
I was born in Mexico City and grew up an hour and a half south of Mexico City in a city called Cuernavaca.
Oh, I love Cuernavaca, yeah.
And then up and down the Pacific coast of Mexico and California.
Okay, but you also did a stint with Middle America in Ann Arbor?
Oh, yes. My dad's taught at Maryland, Michigan, Texas, California. So we kind of did the gauntlet of the United States, and one of my stops.
But you were with one of my old buddies in Ann Arbor, at Zingerman's.
Yes, I did a little stop at Zingerman's, and
they were nominated for a Beard Award. I can't remember what it was though.
I couldn't tell you either. That was actually my first introduction into the cooking world as a career, and was working for them.
Zingerman's, I think it was Best Chef. I think it was Best Chef, Great Lakes, or something like that.
Wow, that's a surprise.
I'm surprised. I don't remember that, actually.
Because they, that's the best deli I've ever been into.
It is a deli, yeah.
And I would have never
but
thought.
But Ari is everywhere, yeah. And he's written books. And they have a catalog of, like, the best products available.
Oh, yeah, no, it is the best.
Yeah.
Ari and Paul, his partner.
So now you had some sort of a revelation that instead of doing, you were studying at the University of Maryland.
Yes.
And it was, what was it, psychology
psychology and criminal justice.
Right. You don't seem the type for that at all.
I was also thinking I was law school bound when I had, a revelation that wasn't me. And I went to work with a friend of mine, and I was changed after that. There was the camaraderie and it was literally the camaraderie that I hadn't felt since playing sports in high school. Kind of drew me right in, and I'd grown up in a household that enjoys eating and dining, being very academic focused. Hospitality wasn't a career option until I saw it myself, and so
and you have a French stepmother who encouraged you because it was such a recognized profession in France.
Yes, she challenged me by saying you're not affectionist. The first time I actually brought that idea of working in the restaurant industry, because in France, like you were saying, all chefs are perfectionists, and it's looked at on such a high level. So I literally changed my philosophy on life in some ways and became, you know, a neat freak and very organized.
Did
and,
you really? Oh, funny.
Yeah, and that wouldn't necessarily say a perfectionist, but definitely perfection-oriented.
Now, you worked in France, which probably yes. shaped your approach to cooking. Classical French training.
Yes, ma'am.
And you matriculated through the Culinary Institute of America, yes. which is probably the
again,
most academic of...
And again,
the,
very, very French, classical French based. Yeah, no, I've been very classically trained. I'd say my style is very contemporary, and I wouldn't say it's with all the current trends that are out there.
Yeah, you're not very experimental.
I wouldn't say it's experimental by any
means. But you've modernized
traditional
and classical. And particularly, I mean, how did you end up in New Orleans?
Oh, that's a long story.
Oh, I can't do a long story. Do a short version.
The short version is after graduating from culinary school, I had high school friends that went to university here that are in the rock band. And I have siblings that live in Portland. And the girl I was dating at the time and I decided to check one out, and whichever one, we flipped a coin, and New Orleans won.
Oh, really? Because Portland's pretty swell, too.
Yeah, yeah. Portland's pretty good, but we planned on being here a year or two, and it turned into 10 years, and now I'd be forever. So.
Wow. Anyhow, let's get down to this menu. I know chefs hate this. Diners, however, do like to know what to expect from the food when they go to a place. We've already established that the atmosphere is relaxed, smart, comfortable.
Yeah.
Okay, and
what would they expect? Surprises with a lot of familiarity.
How about in some examples? Let's do this rest. We have a menu in front of us, the dinner menu, which we haven't sampled yet, but we're going to do that tonight. No.
So a dish that would be a surprise, but at the same time familiarity, would be our crispy pork belly, which comes with crawfish, heirloom red beans, horchata foam, and hot liquor. And when you look at it, it's kind of a hodgepodge of surprises. But at the end of the day, what it is red beans and rice, and kind of drawn into the southern whole idea with the pot liquor being the sauce. So for those aren't familiar, horchata is a rice milk beverage from Mexico, typically drank with spicy foods. And that brings us the rice element to play with the heirloom red beans, pot liquor being the reserved liquid from cooking collard greens. So it just ties in the whole southern kind of familiarity with an element of surprise, because they're not dried red beans and it's not real rice. But at the same time, when you eat it together, it is rice and beans.
Well, yeah, now you have, what is it all of a sudden with this kale? I mean, I was raised on kale, but all of a sudden everybody's discovered kale.
It's super healthy.
Including Gwyneth Paltrow. She's a kale fan.
It's you know, kale is one of the healthiest foods. When you go to Whole Foods, now they have that scale 0 to 1,000 on, I don't know how, I guess on how good it is for you, plus also how good it is for the environment, like the whole kit and caboodle of why something should be eaten.
Really?
And kale's at the top of the list.
Well, that's good, because we grow it.
Yeah, no, and it's excellent. And our kale is kind of a play on everything great from Spain. So it has crispy serrano and plums. And queso casin, which is a special cheese from the Asturias region of Spain. And then a sherry currant vinaigrette and garlic chips.
I mean, you support local growers and
yes.
producers. You go to this cheese place, I understand,
yes,
and
ma'am.
Examine the cheeses and check everything out.
Uh-huh.
But you don't mind ordering from any place.
No. I mean, especially we'd rather make sure it's a top-notch ingredient versus just strictly supporting somebody just because it's local.
I think chefs are really moving in that direction.
And more so than local. I guess we probably aim more at trying to support regional, because the local, to strictly say you're local, kind of, I mean, we go a little further. I mean, we probably go regional, which I think is 300 miles. Is that what the classification? There's some weird classifications on the difference. But yeah, we try to stay to southern ingredients.
What about your wine program? I glanced at your champagne list, which is huge, really. I mean, it's not, I'm talking sparkling, not champagne.
Well, we have a decent selection, and myself and the owner really get involved in making our wines. We try to make wines that are very, you know, that have an ability to blend in with the food and just match and pair well.
Now, you talked about the owner. Now, this is is a partner. She's the owner, but
Astrid Lavinium.
What's her name?
Astrid Lavinium.
Now, has she been a restaurateur for a long time?
Or? No, this is also her first restaurant.
Oh, that must be exciting for her.
Interior vision and decor and everything is her vision.
Okay. So everybody comes here, has to look to make sure that they check the artisan cheese plate, because that's a biggie. Is there some other dish that somebody should absolutely not miss?
Well, we have a sautéed triggerfish with quinoa, butter poached jumbo lump crab meat, sweet potatoes.
And that's all sustainable fish. Triggerfish are good for sustainability.
And a smoked tomato vinaigrette. And that dish kind of jumped up to us. My dad was doing sabbatical work in Bolivia and was walking through Whole Foods and saw the thing that said quinoa hecho in Bolivia. And I was like, why not have something Andes inspired? And that's become our most popular dish. You know, I knew that quinoa was a superfood, but I didn't realize it was going to be a super seller also.
Oh, yeah, it's hot, yeah.
Another one is our duck breast. It is accompanied with a fava bean and wheat locoche risotto, corn pudding, and a guajillo chili duck sauce.
Are you going to let me taste? I've never had that wheat locoche stuff. It's corn fungus.
Yes, it's the corn fungus.
And I'm not sure I ever had it.
It's like the Mexican truffle.
I know, but I think I've been in, I've been in Mexico, but make sure I taste that,
We'll do that dish for sure. And we finish that risotto with queso fresco and quema ranchera, which are two other very Mexican ingredients. So it's kind of a European technique, an item, with very Mexican or Latin items, both being the corn, the fava beans, and the wheat locoche. And then the sauce itself is a guajillo chili reduction, which is kind of taking all the elements of a mole sauce, but instead of pureeing it as a mole, we strain it off and finish it like a classical French reduction sauce. So it has the under flavors of mole with the subtleness of a delicate French reduction.
You know, I'm getting really very excited about this meal. Yeah. I mean,
so that's kind of along the lines of what we do. It's very familiar things mixed in with unfamiliar, but at the same time maintaining very classical technique and focus. You know, that's the most important.
I'm just reminded of something because I'm looking out into South Peter Street and a huge number of people just started walking down the street. And I'm guessing that's probably because it's around 5:30 in the evening and whatever convention is going on at the Convention and Visitors Bureau, I mean at the New Orleans Convention Center just let out.
Yes.
If you go to the convention center and you don't know where to look, it's hard to figure out where to eat. But this is clearly a superbly convenient place to do that because the Convention Center Boulevard is just like about two blocks away.
Yes, sir. So, at most two blocks.
At most two blocks away.
It'll be a short two blocks, to say the least.
Good. Yeah, that's good. So, did we do website?
We didn't, but we can.
Let's do website.
It's really hard because it's meson923.com.
Yes, sir. Yes, that's a tough one.
Again, for the convention center visitor in particular, are you open at lunchtime at all?
No, not yet.
Not
in the
yet.
Fall, we will be open at lunch Thursdays and Fridays.
So it's coming.
Right now,
so it's coming in the future, and
yes,
it's so
Tuesday
it's the evening,
through Saturday.
Tuesday through Saturday, starting at 5:30.
Yes, sir.
Can I be really nasty and ask you, when you're not eating in your own restaurant, where do you eat in New Orleans?
I go to a Vietnamese restaurant called Tan Dinh on the
Which
West Bank.
It?
It's called Tan Dinh.
Tan Dinh.
I go every Monday. And besides that, there is a whole new crop of, I don't know how we'll call them, but restaurant or kind of establishments that are only open on Sundays that they rent out another restaurant's kitchen.
A pop-up, I guess.
A pop-up pizza place. So every Sunday I do the
pizza.
In
Mexican, I read someplace where Mexican cuisine is moving into New Orleans.
Oh, yes, and I go to the taco trucks. And then, but if I'm going to do fine dining, I either go to Lalette or where my friend is the chef, a restaurant called Gotro's. So I either go to Lalette or Gotro's.
The chef there is who?
Susan Zemanek.
She just got a beer denomination.
Yes, she did. She's an old friend of mine.
Well, I mean, I've been reading about her, and that's why I was trying to remember her name to tell Peter. Well, you know, we could chat, obviously, but I'm really getting very hungry because this looks like a very, very wonderful menu. And you're so much fun to talk to. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And we'll have some good things for you to try tonight.
Great. And for those of you taking notes, spell this M-E-S-O-N 923, which is Spanish and not French, M-A-I-S-O-N. And the meaning is even broader, as you could tell from the interview. Well, with that, we can now go to another short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Well, the last interview in today's program is one we mentioned at the beginning. It's might be subtitled, "Why on Earth Did You Decide to Do That?" Why would a man with most of his sanity intact decide at age 38 to enroll at the Culinary Institute of America in order to become a chef? Well, he wrote a book about it. It was a fascinating experience for him. I'm sure you'll find his interview equally fascinating, and you'll probably want to rush out and get the book too. So, Beaten, Something, and Stirred.
Seared.
Beaten, seared, and stirred. sounds like what might happen to you at the place, and indeed it did. So here's the author.
Jonathan Dixon has written a book called Beaten, Seared, and Sauced, subtitled On Becoming a Chef at the Culinary Institute of America. Jonathan, I read the book cover to cover, and welcome to On the Menu.
Well, thank you very much for having me. This is really exciting. This is my first real interview.
Oh, okay. Well
you're probably going to do a few more. I wouldn't be surprised. Huh?
I'm hoping. You know?
Now, Anne was asking you before you came on the air, because there was another book written that was, in a way, sort of similar, called The Making of a Chef by the famous Michael Ruhlman.
Yes.
Did you decide to do Ruhlman all over again, or you know, what was going to be different?
Well, I had every single student on that campus, I had read Michael Ruhlman's book more than once. And I had never intended to actually write a book when I went to school. I just wanted to be a student. I wanted to learn.
See, and that was my question, because you are trained as a writer and as a journalist.
Yes,
and I wondered if you had this in the back of your head, that you were going to be writing about this experience, because it seems in parts almost as if you were really writing this book from notes.
Well, what happened was I was trained as a fiction writer. You know, I received my MFA from Hunter College, and when I got to school, I thought, okay, I will... All my classes were in the late afternoon into the evening, and I said, okay, well, in the morning, I will work on my writing, and then at night, I will magically transform into completely dedicated student. And I couldn't quite keep making the mental switch. At the CIA, it's just all food all the time, and you're just constantly immersed in this world of cooking and ingredients and technique, and just constantly thinking about food. And I couldn't make the switch, but I still had this kind of graphomaniacal urge to write. And some of my friends encouraged me to do a blog, and that sort of scratched the writing itch. And I sent the link to the blog out to several friends, and one of them was the managing editor at SeriousEats.com, and he posted
Ed,
the
is
link.
That Ed?
It's Adam Kubin.
Oh, I know Adam.
Yes.
Yeah. He's on my Twitter list.
He and I worked together at Martha Stewart.
He's very funny. I mean, his tweets are really hilarious.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy.
Yeah.
He's really smart, and he is really funny.
Yeah. Okay, so back to, you were exposed to food and Martha Stewart.
Yeah, once Adam posted to that blog, it just kind of went from there, and before I knew it, I had been approached about possibly turning the blog into a book, and I wrestled with that for a little bit and then decided, well, why not? And I was kind of ultimately writing the book while I was going to school.
Yeah, I had that feeling, actually. You know, I mean, when I was reading it, I felt like that. I mean, that was the case.
It was sort of a diary, in a sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because, I mean, you make some really fine-tuned evaluations of your emotions at a particular situation. That was one of the things that I thought led to my belief that you were doing a diary.
Yes. Well, that was ultimately what I thought, because I worried about Michael Ruhlman's book, and ultimately I decided that Michael Roman had had, from what I understand, he'd had a pretty good bit of journalism experience. He worked for the New York Times for a little while, and he had gone to journalism school.
I thought that
his account of life at the CIA was a really good piece of journalistic work. But he kept himself, I think, out of the story more than I did, and I felt that mine was kind of a much more emotionally personal account of what it's like to get that education. And I say in the acknowledgments, I acknowledged his book as sort of an inspiration and said that, you know, my goal was to supplement it and not supplant it. So hopefully they sit peacefully side by side on the bookshelf.
You know, I don't want to be a spoiler, but I think say to our listeners what you ended up being chef-wise.
Well, I am cooking privately in Manhattan for a couple different people.
Okay, so you're a private chef.
Yes.
Now, let's get to, I think, the crux of the difference between your book and Roman's. I mean, you actually set out to be a chef and started enrolling in the Culinary Institute of America, known for being tough, at age 38, and you're studying to be a chef, which is a young man's profession or a young woman's profession, a young person's profession.
Yes.
That was crazy, you know.
Yeah, oh, you have no idea.
I do. No, I mean, I used to own a restaurant, so
I remember hearing that you owned a restaurant.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can't even imagine at 38 starting at the Culinary Institute.
Now, here's the question. Do you think the CIA likes the book? You make it seem like it's awfully hard work.
Well, they do like the book, actually. And a few weeks ago, they invited me in to address some students and, you know, read a little bit from the book and answer some questions about my experience at the school. I was originally worried that when the book came out, the CIA might really hate it and that Tim Ryan might have my car wired or something like
the
that.
The Pittsburgh Mafia. That's why.
But they did like the book, which I was grateful for.
You say some really important things about how, even though it can be strict and bizarre and erratic, that your treatment as a student there, that they do accomplish this motivation. And I think that you also sort of indicate that they take some pretty unruly raw material and shape them into the people who take the profession seriously.
I think that's true. And you know, I say in Beaten, Seared, and Sauce that I draw a comparison between West Point, that's just down the river.
Right.
And, you know, it's probably not that dissimilar. I mean, there's a real disciplined approach to imparting that education at the CIA.
And then the other major difference, of course, is that you dwell on your externship. And this is where, I mean, I'm really at odds with you on this because I was startled. I mean, I was truly startled about your experiences at Tabla, the now defunct Tabla, because we know and have worked with and love this chef. And he just about cut your head off.
Well, I think that, as you pointed out, that working in a restaurant is a young person's game. And except for Floyd Cardoz, I really was the oldest person working in that kitchen. And I think that people in the kitchen saw me as a bit of a dilettante. And I think that maybe consciously, maybe unconsciously, they decided that they were really going to give me the kitchen experience. And thus they did.
But you mean the difficult kitchen experience?
Yes, the hazing and all that sort of thing. And but I did not have a lot of fun during my externship, but I have to say that I learned a tremendous amount. And while I was there afterward and today, I have a ton of respect for how Cardoz ran that kitchen and for the food that he put out. And no matter how I felt, and I do also think that I make it somewhat clear in the book that ultimately I came to realize that a lot of my difficulties in the kitchen were my own doing. And I came to kind of really respect what went on in that kitchen as far as the execution and their 12 years of success. I really came to respect that quite a bit.
Yeah, I thought the food was terrific there. I'm surprised that they never could make a go of it.
My theory is that I think that people have a perception of foods like Indian food and Chinese food yeah. as something that should be inexpensive.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that maybe it's a tougher sell in New York, especially where Tableau is located, right around the corner there, you know, in the upper 20s by Lexington Avenue, there are just innumerable restaurants and shops, like Indian restaurants and shops. And they had the largest number of seats in any Danny Meyer restaurant, and I think that might have been difficult to keep filling those seats night after night.
Yeah.
But they did do it for about 12 years.
Yeah, which is remarkable.
Now, as a result of your experience, now let's suppose now that you have young children or nieces and nephews, and you're suggesting to them how they might proceed with their career. What would you tell them going into CIA? First of all, would you tell them to go? And then secondly, what would you tell them to expect?
I would tell them to go because it was a really profound experience that I had over the course of 2 years. Sometimes that I wasn't even aware I was undergoing such a profound experience. It was more being recollected in tranquility that I got to really assess how much of a change I went through. But I would tell, if I don't have kids, but if I did, and I do have nephews, I would tell them, open your ears, open your eyes, listen, read, and get as involved as you possibly can. Soak up every bit of info that comes your way and take every opportunity you can.
But boy, they breeze through the subject matter, don't they? And then 2 days in Central America or something, you know?
Yeah, that I think is one of the flaws of the program, is how quickly you do breeze through things. But I think that once you get through a certain number of their classes, I think that you have a really good grounding, and again, just grounding, in all the techniques that every cuisine around the world uses: braising, sautéing, roasting, poaching, etc. And at that point, once you have those fundamentals down, it's a matter of learning about flavors and then refining it. So it does, in one sense, it is really absurd to think that you're going to spend 2 days in Central America and come away with any sort of knowledge about
that. I think it was 2 days in Central and South America.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But if your intellectual curiosity is at a good peak, they kind of get you to dip your toe in the water, and then at that point, it's your job to go and explore other things. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to go to Tableau was because I was really fascinated by Indian food and those combinations of spices and that sort of
thing. Just one final question for you, Jonathan. We've heard people in the profession, we know a lot of chefs and restaurant owners, and speaking of young people who have been to other cooking schools, so probably doesn't apply to CIA, that the students come out thinking they are chefs. And what really happens is when they go to work in a restaurant, the people who are in the restaurant believe, rightly or wrongly, that they have to really begin teaching them from the beginning because they really don't know how to be chefs. What would you say about the CIA experience against that?
You are not a chef when you emerge. I mean, that's like coming out of basic training in boot camp and deciding you're a colonel. You know, it doesn't quite work that way. You have the potential and the bedrock education to become a chef later on down the line, but you are basically better trained when you come out, and that at that point, that's where the real education starts.
We think that you had a great adventure, and it's wonderful that you shared it with everybody, because I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about this. This is not a trivial investment that you made. It's not a trivial investment that the student or whoever the student's financial supporter is going to be. So it might very well be worth the $20-some or so to get a copy of this book and study it before you decide to apply it, do you think?
I do, but I do think it's important to remember one thing, is that the food industry is immense. I mean, billions and billions of dollars in this country alone. And there are many, many opportunities in that industry to make one's mark. And they don't all have to be a line cook at a restaurant. There are a lot of other things that one can do. So when you come out of cooking school with that training, I think most people sort of assume that they're going to go work in a restaurant, but there are many, many things that one can do.
Well, you were 38 when you started. I admit to 68 right now. I don't think I'm headed off the Culinary Institute of America at Hyde Park any day soon, because I'm sure my constitution wouldn't stand it. But I'm glad that you shared your experience in this wonderful book, Beaten,
Seared and Sauced, which is a great title, too. Jonathan, I wish you great luck with the selling the book, too. I hope it gets out there.
I hope that, too.
Well, good luck to you.
Great, and thank you very much for having me on.
And we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.